Tonight on Arena, former Cocteau twin Simon Raymond is back in the saddle with his Lost Horizons project and Julia Parry on the love letters of Elizabeth Bowen. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Simon Raymond is best known to music fans as the bass player and keyboardist in the iconic band Cocteau Twins. He was there from 1983 through until 1997. But in that same year, 1997, he and fellow Cocteau twin Robin Guthrie formed the record label Bella Union, that was subsequently lauded for its championing of musicians from Fleet Foxes to the Flaming Lips and indeed our own Fionn Regan. More recently, Simon embarked on a fresh musical venture of his own entitled Lost Horizons. Last December, Lost Horizons released the first part of a two-part project called In Quiet Moments. Part two of In Quiet Moments will be released this Friday, and I'm delighted to have Simon Raymond join me on Arena this evening. Simon, 1997, as I said, two big events, I suppose. Effectively, Cocteau Twins stopped performing and making music, and Bella Union, the record label, was founded. But in the between 1997 and 2017, as a musician, you were busy as a record label man for sure. But as a musician, publicly at any rate, you were pretty quiet. Why that long silence, and what changed in 2017 to persuade you to get involved in Lost Horizons, this new project?
Yes. Hello, Sean. Thank you for that. Yeah, indeed, 20 years is a ridiculous length of time to be between music projects. I mean, I had done a few, I dabbled here and there, you know, playing on people's records and whatnot, but not sort of dip my toe deep in like I'm doing now. So, yeah, it was really the 20th anniversary of Bella Union that kind of sparked this all off, because I was sort of getting plans together for gigs and anniversary releases and whatnot. Mm. And I just was like not feeling fully happy and satisfied, and I couldn't work out why. You know, 20 years should be something big, should be really feeling like celebrating. But I sort of quickly worked out that it was, you know, that I wasn't making music, and that was this big hole that was missing in my life. I mean, it's pretty obvious to everyone else, I'm sure, but for some reason, it wasn't to me. And I just set about doing something about it as quickly as possible. You know, time is marching on, and I was feeling like that really needed to happen in my life. Yeah. So I contacted my current partner in the band, Richie Thomas, who's an old mate of mine from the Cocteau's days, and just said, do you fancy messing about, you know, doing something with no real view, Sean, of ever really having a band particularly, or even a record. I was just missing the music making.
And I wonder, you know, was it a case that perhaps Bella Union, which was obviously a hugely successful label for you, and no surprise that you would want to celebrate 20 years of it, was it that had just taken the eye had got was taken off the ball, if you like, in terms of playing music? Or had you at different times along the way thought, I'm just leaving the playing to the one side, even though you were doing those little bits and pieces here and there? But was it just that your attention was gone elsewhere?
Oh yeah, massively. There was never a conscious decision, music's not for me. I mean, absolutely not. It was, you know, it is a very distracting and full-on kind of operation running a small independent label. And, you know, during those 20 years, I mean, it would be a lie not to say there were some incredibly difficult moments, you know, financially veering from doing all right to kind of almost being on the edge of bankruptcy. You know, it just happens that way because the business is all about spending money up front. You know, you sign a band, you make the record, you do all the spend ahead of anybody buying it. And of course, if no one buys it, you're kind of stuffed, you know, because you spent all this money. So it does sort of lurch from being very positive to being, oh my God, how am I going to pay the rent? Yeah. You know, and there were moments in that 20 years where we did sort of lurch from one end to the other. Fleet Foxes, as you mentioned there, was obviously a huge band for us, and by far and away the biggest selling artist on the label during that period, and going from sort of doing 30,000 or 40,000 of bands like Midlake and so forth. You know, Fleet Foxes sold 1 million records in Europe, and that sort of took us into a different stratosphere, you know, as a label. So yes, it was very distracting, and I wanted to make music. It's just that I didn't really probably in the back of my mind feel that any band was going to be probably quite as good as my previous band.
Yeah.
I find a singer as good as Elizabeth Fraser from Cocteau Twins is not something you just walk into every day, you know?
And interestingly enough, then, when we come to Lost Horizons, you've found several singers for us across the two albums, in fact. And, you know,
maybe
some
it's because I couldn't find one.
But the ones that you found, them, you've done quite well with them, let's be honest, certainly from to my ears. Tell me a little bit about, I want to play the opening track, the title track effectively on the second part of the project, the one that's been released on Friday, In Quiet Moments, the title of the track, obviously, and the title of the double album, as it were. Ural Thomas, who is he?
Yeah. I mean, even a couple of years ago, I had no idea either. He was not a name that was on my radar at all, but I got this email out of the blue, as you know, to me as the boss of Bella Union, asking if I was aware of this artist Ural Thomas and would I like to listen to his demos, because he had a new record in the offing. And when I delved into it, I realised he wasn't a new artist at all. He was in fact 80 years old. And you know, the story became more and more fascinating as I delve deeper into it. He was around in the 60s making music, working with the likes of Otis Redding, Stevie Wonder, James Brown, Etta James. I mean, you know, an incredible past. But then when it got to around about 1970, it seemed that he just disappeared off the face of the earth. And I haven't really fully got to the bottom of why that was. I just think the music business and he didn't quite see eye to eye, you know, and he just didn't like it much. And like a lot of people, just decided to butt out, you know. So from about 1970 through till 2015, yeah, I've gone on about how I wasn't making music for 20 years. This chap hadn't been making it for, you know, a heck of a lot longer than that. So these producers in Portland, Oregon, where he was living, had heard that he was there, and they were crate digging and crate diggers, you know, people that go around record shops looking for old vinyl, you know, to play out at parties and whatnot. And they heard he was living there and got in contact with him and said, "Hey, man, I mean, do you fancy doing something? Are you busy?" And I think he loved the idea that, you know, some people knew who he was, and he started making music again at the ripe old age of, well, 2015, he would have been probably 76.
Well,
he's now 82.
Yeah.
He's now 82. And we are about to put the finishing touches to a record deal with him to be able to release Ural Thomas's own music,
right,
which obviously will follow the track you mentioned there.
Yeah, well, let's listen to the track. 82 years old is what you said.
Yeah.
So just listen to the voice in the title track here, In Quiet Moments.
Has anyone seen the tree blowing gently in the breeze, just like me?
And that's the voice of Ural Thomas there. A lot of singers would be quite happy to sound like that in their 60s, even in their 70s, but to sound like that in your 80s, wow, well, good on him.
Yeah.
And glad that you have him back. I'm speaking this evening with Simon Raymond, and the song that we just heard is the title track from Lost Horizons, the latest project from Simon Raymond. He's been doing this project into 2017, as we mentioned, and In Quiet Moments, the title of this double album, second part of which we're getting on Friday. Am I right to even be calling it a double album, or do you think of it in some different way, Simon?
No, it is exactly what it is. I mean, the reason for splitting it into two parts is a bit unusual, but I thought, because of the nature of the project, the fact that it's got a different singer on each song, and stylistically from track to track it's quite eclectic, I felt that to try and promote the record in the same way normal artists promote their band, i.e., you know, a couple of singles and then the album comes out, I thought that would probably be very confusing for the audience, because, you know, if they heard one song by, let's say, the track I did with Porridge Radio and then perhaps the track I did with John Grant, they're so wildly different. Just two tracks out there before the album come out just really wouldn't give people any idea what it was. They'd be utterly confused, I'm sure. So I decided to split it into two to give a sort of longer drip feed of tracks before the actual final thing came out, so that, you know, by Friday people will have heard maybe, you know, 8, 9, 10 of the songs and, you know, finally getting a clue as to what this record is all about.
It really struck me, man, the way you've just explained it there as well, that what's happening with Lost Horizons, and particularly with In Quiet Moments, it really is the mix of you, Simon Raymond, the musician, and Simon Raymond, the label man, because you're bringing the two skills together maybe in a way you hadn't expected.
Yeah, that's 100% correct. And I mean, that wasn't ever really, you know, a conscious decision at the beginning, because, you know, the music is made. All the music is finished first before any singers are contacted. And the music is all kind of improvised, the initial stages of it anyhow. I sit down with Richie in a room and we just have no ideas, no tunes. We just literally press record on the machine and we just record our messing about. And then I bring that stuff back home and then I slowly build layers of music on top of it. I put the bass and the guitars on and, you know, make it sound like a fully finished instrumental. And at that point, when I feel like, okay, I can't really think of anything else this track needs musically, I just sit there quietly with my eyes shut and just try and imagine who I would love to hear singing on it. The Ural Thomas one was it just coincided with that email from these producers saying, you know, we'd love you to listen to Ural's demos. And as I was listening to them, I was making this track, the music of which you just played there. And I was thinking, blimey, I am going to talk to him about maybe working with Bell Union. But you know what? I would love that chap to sing on my record. I wonder if I dare ask him. And that's the sort of process. You know, you just email and say, look, I don't know if you know who I am, but blah, 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 here's this thing. Do you fancy maybe having some fun with it? And that's the kind of project. Yeah. It's very much just like kind of feeling people out and seeing if they have a connection with the piece.
Is it a very different, you know, do you see it as a very different project and a very different way of making music from the way you made music back in the day with the Cocteau Twins? Given the presence of Richie there, obviously, there might be some similarities, I guess. But or do you think of it as some sort of continuum? It's still me, Simon, making the music. Is that what's in your mind and that things aren't that different, really, from the Cocteau Twin days?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it might seem very different in so many ways, you know, because of the nature of the project with all the different singers and the different protagonists and the different styles. But the actual basic way of construction of music, of the composition stuff, is exactly the same as how the Cocteau Twins made our music. Robin and I would sit in a room, and exactly the same way that Richie and I do, and just improvise stuff. And then, you know, we'd start in the morning and by the evening we'd have a finished piece of music, and we'd do that 10 times until we had 10 finished instrumentals. And at that point, Elizabeth would then come in and start doing her thing. It is a really unusual way of working. And certainly in Lost Horizons, when I do approach singers, some who are quite new to the game do find it quite challenging, because, as you know, you're sort of thinking of a melody and a lyric to go with something that you're not involved with, that, you know, that I've created. So it is quite unusual, and you have to sort of, you know, explain it to the singers what you're trying to achieve here, and just tell them to let go and not think too much about it. Don't analyze it. Just let go and sing. I know that sounds simple, but sometimes you need to bring things back to a quite basic level, and it is just all about reacting to the music. That's what improvisation is about.
Well, it's like in quiet moments, it kind of says it to us. Two things that really struck me. The first album from Lost Horizons, November 2017. I might not have the pronunciation right. Ojala, possibly. The word hopefully, I think, is one of the translations there, or God willing. So was there a sense of, you know, fingers crossed and or perhaps hands together praying, hoping that this project was going to work? And now, whatever, a few years down the line, do you get a sense of, oh, this is working, and maybe in a way I couldn't even have hoped for?
Oh, well, possibly, yeah. It's pronounced ojalá.
Ojalá.
And it's the Spanish word that, as you say, means hope. And it really wasn't so much hope that we'd continue doing it. It was more about a hope, you know, a hope for the world. Because, you know, even, I mean, I know things 3 years down, like 4 years down the line from that first album are considerably different and harder for a lot of people. Even in 2017, things weren't that great. And our hope was that, you know, things would improve in the future. With this new record, actually, the catalyst for starting album two in Quiet Moments was actually something not that, you know, not nice. My mum passed away in 2018, and I think following her death, I hadn't grieved it very, very well at the time it happened, because there was a long illness that sort of built up to it. But as you know, after she died, I think I just needed to do something in the studio, to be creative and get out some of the stuff that was buried deep inside. So it was that sort of sad event that spawned the start of this record. And that's sort of, you know, how the songs began.
And that maybe explains much more precise way the use of In Quiet Moments, I'm guessing.
Yes, I mean that, and because when Ural Thomas wrote those lyrics, it was actually prior to lockdown. I mixed the record during the lockdown, and quite a few of the tracks were finished from sort of March last year around through to about September. But those lyrics, they, you know, they're just so poignant for so much of what we're going through from there, what you said about my mum passing away, and then just looking at these four walls that we're all stuck with looking at for the last year and a half. It was just such a perfect title. When we discussed what we would call the album, it just jumped out, you know, that's it. There's that his title right there. That's the album. No, there was no other options.
It's great to speak with you, by the way, Simon. It's been a real joy. But I want to finish up with another song from the new album, from the second part of In Quiet Moments. The singer, Kuki Lou. Tell us about her and the song we're about to hear, Heart of a Hummingbird.
Oh, well, Kuki Lou is Lily Walter. Lily Walter is one half of Penelope Isles, which is a young band who live here in Brighton that me and my wife manage, and who are also signed to Belly Union, an unbelievable band. They put their first record out, actually also in 2017. And we just absolutely adore them. Jack, her brother, sings on the first track on part one, Halcyon. And Lily, whose own solo project goes under the name Kuki Lou, is the singer of this. And they were the first two people I asked to be on the new Lost Horizons record, just because I love them so much and think they're incredibly talented.
And it gives us a real sense of, you know, Ural Thomas at one end of his life and career, and Lily and her brother Jack at the other end of their lives and career, let us
hope.
Thanks a million for speaking to us this evening, Simon. A real pleasure.
Thank you, Sean.
That's Simon Raymond there, and let's listen to Lost Horizons, the new project, or the new album rather, In Quiet Moments, a song called Heart of a Hummingbird. Lily. little taste there of Heart of a Hummingbird featuring the vocal talents of Cookie Lou, and that from the Lost Horizons project of Simon Raymond and the new album In Quiet Moments. Part 2 will be released this Friday, February the 26th, and you can find part 1 of In Quiet Moments on Spotify and other platforms. And great to speak to former Cocteau Twins Simon Raymond about all of that earlier. Poet and publisher Lawrence Ferlinghetti, one of the leading figures of the Beat movement, has died at the age of 101. He was joint founder of the iconic City Lights Bookshop in North Beach, San Francisco, and long associated with the writers Jack Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg and William S. Burroughs. On the 7th of July 2004, Lawrence Ferlinghetti was in Dublin, where he gave a public interview to Miles Dungan on RTÉ Radio 1's Rattlebag. Ferlinghetti was a sailor in World War II and was with the Allies when they entered Nagasaki a few weeks after the atomic bomb attack. Here is Lawrence Ferlinghetti reading his poem, Coney Island of the Mind.
In a surrealist year of sandwich men and sunbathers, dead sunflowers and live telephones, housebroken politicos with party whips, performed as usual in the rings of their sawdust circuses, where tumblers and human cannonballs fill the air like cries, when some cool clown pressed an inedible mushroom button and an inaudible Sunday bomb fell down, catching the president at his prayers on the 19th green. And it was a spring of fir leaves and cobalt flowers where Cadillacs fell through the trees like rain, drowning the meadows with madness, while out of every imitation cloud dropped myriad wingless crowds of nutless Nagasaki survivors and lost teacups full of our ashes floated by.
Lawrence Ferlinghetti there reading Coney Island of the Mind in a public interview with Miles Dungan on Rattlebag back in July 2004. Miles asked Lawrence to recall the establishment of the City Lights Bookshop in San Francisco and first of all to explain how the shop got its name.
That naturally came from the Chaplin movie. It happened that the idea for an all paperbound bookstore was my partner then was Peter Dean Martin, who was a sociology instructor at San Francisco State University. He was a brilliant fellow, and it was his idea. There were no paperback bookstores. Paperback books weren't considered real books by the book trade. It was the beginning of what became known as the quality paperback book revolution, starting in 1953 or so. Two New York publishers started publishing quality paperbacks, the best literature. And there was a huge demand for it, and there was no place to buy them because up to then, paperbacks had been just sold in cigar stands and newsstands. And so we were open from till midnight, 7 days a week, right from the beginning. You couldn't get the door closed. It was all Peter Martin's idea. It was all his fault. I wanted to have a used bookstore because my friend George Whitman, who has Shakespeare and Company in Paris, he was still selling books out of a pushcart along the Seine, but he hadn't in mind he was going to start a bookstore.
He's still doing it, isn't he?
Yes.
Mm. Now, at some point, you began the Pocket Poets series, which was to be become very, very important and very, very famous. What was the idea behind the Pocket Poets series, given that it clearly wasn't a drive to enlist support for poets of small stature?
It was the idea that you could put the book in your pocket, not the poet. Well, a small, cheap edition, which is something new at that time. At that time, as in England, there were many fine letterpress editions of books, which weren't cheap. There weren't paperbacks of poetry generally, and so that was the idea for make it a. It was really a populist concept.
I'm going to talk about one of the editions of that series, number four, which came to be very, very important. But City Lights was one of the main catalysts for the arrival of what became called the Beat Generation. And around this time, there was a famous night of six poets at the Six Gallery in San Francisco at a reading. Can you tell us a little bit about that reading?
Well, they were all New York carpetbaggers like me. A carpetbagger comes from the American Civil War, when the Yankees went down south peddling various kinds of goods. And this was like an Allen Ginsberg, Jack Kerouac, William Burroughs, Gregory Corso, myself, we were all from the East Coast. Because when Allen Ginsberg read Howl, and we published the book, it's like it kicked the sides out of the whole poetry scene as it had existed up to then. Up to then, poetry had been very academic. It was a little like when the rock revolution happened in the early 60s. The Fillmore Auditorium with the early Jefferson Airplane. That up to then in the music scene, cool jazz was the big thing, and cool jazz in the 50s. And when the rock revolution happened, you didn't hear any more cool jazz for a long time. And that's what happened. You didn't hear any more academic poetry, at least in San Francisco, for a long time after the Ginsberg Address. We had the Gettysburg Address, then we had the Ginsberg Address.
The Ginsberg Address, as you say, Howl and Other Poems, was that fourth volume, the fourth volume in the Pocket Poets series. And that resulted in a famous obscenity trial in 1956. Can you tell us a little bit about all of that?
Yeah, this was the original edition of Howl was letterpress, printed in England by John Sankey at Villiers Publications. It was seized by the U.S. Customs in San Francisco, but the district attorney refused to prosecute, and so Customs had to release the book, and so we had it at the bookstore, we were selling it, and then the local police walked in, actually it was the juvenile department, and arrested the clerk at the desk selling the book, and I was charged with the clerk as publishing and selling obscene literature. And then we had a long trial in the municipal court in San Francisco with many distinguished critics on our side. It wasn't a jury, it was just a judge. And he ruled that that as long as there was any social significance in the book, it could not be ruled obscene. And that precedence has stood up. It opened the floodgates and allowed New York publishers like the Grove Press to publish Lady Chatterley's Lover and Henry Miller's Tropics, and Jean Genet, and the whole floodgates were open, I mean, after that. And that, even though it was only a municipal court, that precedent still holds sway.
Did you anticipate trouble when you published Howl?
Oh, yeah, in fact.
You welcomed it?
I submitted the manuscript to the American Civil Liberties Union before we sent it to the printer and said, would you defend us if we were busted for this? And they said they would. And thank God for the American Civil Liberties Union, because we were just a little one-room bookstore. We didn't have any money for lawyers, and we would have been out of business. Of course, that's what Republican regimes particularly have been very good at in prosecuting the left in the United States by that kind of harassment or arrest.
Lawrence Ferlinghetti there in conversation with Miles Dungan from Rattlebag back in 2004. And Lawrence Ferlinghetti has died at the age of 101. And our thanks to Rob Canning, our colleague in archives, for accessing that interview for us. Is it possible for a filmmaker to ascend to the pantheon of directors without winning any awards, without achieving critical adulation, or even enjoying commercial success? Well, tonight we're looking at a director whose name you might not know, whose films you may not have seen, but whose work has influenced filmmakers such as Ridley Scott, Quentin Tarantino, Steven Soderbergh and Christopher Nolan. They all revere the same person, the British director Nicholas Roeg. So what was it about Roeg that caught their imagination? I'm joined now by Stephen Benedict to help us answer that question. Maybe first of all, where are we in time when we talk about Roeg at the height of his powers? Stephen?
It really is between 1970, when he made his first movie, Performance, starring Mick Jagger and Edward Fox. The movie is about a London gangster hiding out from the police in the basement of a rock star's house. And then he follows it with Walkabout the next year in 71, Don't Look Now in 73, The Man Who Fell to Earth, starring David Bowie in 75, and bringing us right through, I think, to Rogue's last great picture in 1980, Bad Timing, starring Art Garfunkel and Teresa Russell.
We'll come back to the preponderance of pop stars in his films in a while. But let me go back to that question then. I said Tarantino, Scott, Soderbergh, Christopher Nolan. What was it about Rogue that caught their imagination?
Without being smart, I think it was his surname. You know, I'm not kidding. If ever there was a director who lived up to his surname, it's Nicholas Rogue. His movies went rogue, you know, as I was saying, listing off those titles. The movies were released like loose cannons. It was the content that Rogue chose repeatedly was offbeat, unsettling, and quite often disturbing. And it was also then the way he treated that content again, which was he treated it in an offbeat way, an unsettling way, and disturbing way. And I think because of that, Rogue became a rarity in British film. He was an iconoclast. You know, he was a cinematic agent provocateur. He made incendiary films. And it's interesting that the movie directors you've listed, who are more mainstream, have taken this avant-garde approach that Rogue had in his films and placed it in their own films.
So we're talking in the case of those, Ridley Scott, Tarantino, etc., we're talking about a later era. Well, then let's go back to pre-1970 and what it was. First of all, was Rogue kicking against something when he decided to be this agent provocateur, as you say? Or who was influencing him in doing that? Who had influenced him in the 50s and 60s, I guess, to do what he did in the 70s and 80s?
Well, it's a good question, because he actually started his career as a cinematographer, working with, you know, big names in the 1960s, François Truffaut, David Lean and John Schlesinger. But their style of filmmaking didn't influence him. He was more responsive to what was happening elsewhere. And, you know, you're absolutely right. The 1960s were very, very heady days of experimentation. So we think about the filmmakers like Federico Fellini, who was specialising in stream of consciousness. And you've got Luis Buñuel and his surreal juxtapositions. And then Ingmar Bergman would be another influence or a possible touchstone for Rogue and the way he was probing the human psyche. But also, just as importantly, Jean-Luc Godard. I mean, Godard in 8 years between 59 and 67 made 15 films. And each one of them demolished film grammar as filmmakers knew it. And so if you could imagine all those directors as circles in a Venn diagram, and Nicholas Rogue was the person or the talent that brought them all together. Now, I'm not saying for a second that Nicholas Rogue was an imitator. He wasn't. He was an innovator. And what he took was he took those ideas and he presented them with his own unique brand of filmmaking and storytelling.
Now, he would turn in his grave if he thought we were going to tell the story chronologically. But I'm sorry, Nicholas, that's what we're going to do. We're going to tell the story chronologically. So let us start with Performance, which he co-directed with Donald Cammell, who was a painter. Now, that might tell us, or does it, tell us something about visually what Rogue was aiming for with the presence of this co-director?
Yeah, that's a very good place to start. I mean, you know, as you said, we're going against the grain of what Rogue was doing. But what he did was, you know, this was in the heady 1960s and Warner Brothers in Hollywood wanted to get involved in this and they financed this film. And what Cammell and Rogue did was they began the story and almost, as they're making the film, they were sticking very, very closely to the script. And then they decided to ditch it, to throw the whole thing away. And what resulted was a film that charts the dissolution of these two characters, their personalities, through the altercations that they have in the basement of this house. And then ever so slightly, very, very gradually, but very, very shockingly, their personalities seem to merge and then split and swap.
So now, the two characters are James Fox as a kind of London gangster who's hiding out in the basement of this reclusive rock star.
That's correct.
Played by Mick Jagger.
Yes. And so at the end, you know, there was another influence, the writings of William Burroughs, for example, or Borges. They took these literary devices, literary ideas, and infused it into the film. But the reason why the film had such an impact and offended the Warner Brothers studios so much was because it went against the grain of what filmmaking, the way stories were supposed to be told. What Rogue really did, which was quite unusual considering his background was cinematography, he was fascinated with the editing of film, with the language of film and the properties that editing allowed film to do. he began, as I said, as a cinematographer, but he actually began, you know, as an intern or, you know, shall we say, a tea boy working on Wardour Street in London. And one day he happened to walk into a dubbing studio and he saw the film being put on loop on the screen again and again and again, and then being rewound as the actors then tried to find the place where they could actually dub the movie into a foreign language. And he was absolutely gripped by this possibility of bending time and then playing the picture against the image. So you don't actually hear the sounds that you should be seeing on the screen. And that was what made his films very, very innovative and avant-garde. And that sort of technique ripples all the way through his films, from Persona to Walkabout and Don't Look Now. And then you can see it in the works of Tarantino and Steven Soderbergh and Christopher Nolan. Yeah.
Let's have a listen to a sequence. This is called the Memo from Turner sequence from Performance. Explain what that Memo from Turner sequence, what do I mean by that?
Well, it's a song. It's actually considered to be one of the first pop videos that turn up in a movie. One of the characters is actually shot in the head and the camera follows the bullet as it enters the brain, and it enters into this very, very, very strange space, and all of a sudden you've got this song, Memos from Turner, sung by Mick Jagger.
You know, that Spanish-speaking gentleman, the one that we all call Kurt.
It was Mag Cyril.
Come now, gentlemen, I know there's some mistake. How forgetful I'm becoming now you fix your
We've been courteous.
I remember you in Hemlock Road in 1956.
There we go. The Memo from Turner sequence from Performance, the debut film of Nicholas Rogue, and Stephen Benedict is speaking to us about the Rogue film director that Rogue was. Yes, you can hear, you can even see the fun that they're having talking over the music as we heard it there at one level, Stephen. But that idea I mentioned to you, you know, you said Mick Jagger, you said Art Garfunkel, and of course David Bowie in The Man Who Fell to Earth. What was it, do you think, that attracted Rogue about casting big pops and rock stars like that in his films?
I think it allowed him to offset our impression of what that rock star was. You know, in Performance, Jagger brings his phenomenal charisma, but then the movie examines androgyny and the swapping and switching of personalities. It's something that, you know, Mick Jagger would have been playing a little bit on the androgyny in the 60s. But then if we think about David Bowie, the casting of David Bowie, you know, he first bursts onto the rock scene as Ziggy Stardust, and he goes through another persona with Aladdin Sane, and then he reinvents himself as Halloween Jack. And so by the time he goes to make The Man Who Fell to Earth in 1975, audiences were familiar with this ethereal otherworldliness of David Bowie. So it's quite appropriate that Bowie would be cast as an alien coming to visit from outer space. But the brilliant thing about the movie is, excuse the pun, it is, yes, about alienation. So he's using David Bowie as a sort of a conduit to explore this. But the brilliant thing about the movie is, instead of presenting in a cliche fashion the alien on the run from the police or the authorities or the army, scientists trying to track him down, he disappears into mainstream society as an engineer and as a sound engineer. And the movie then studies his alienation, which results from consumerism and media saturation. And that is something that we can all understand. Yeah. So it's not necessarily an alien experience. He's using Bowie to sort of to introduce us to these ideas, but then offset our expectation as to who David Bowie is. And that becomes very, very apparent in 1980 when he makes Bad Timing Stories starring Art Garfunkel, who would have been considered by many, many audiences as a very benign pop star, you know, with Simon and Garfunkel, really, really pleasant melodies and an absolutely angelic voice. But the character he plays in Bad Timing is anything but.
Yeah. So Rogue knew exactly what he was doing, playing around with the expectations of the particular stars in question. Let's you mentioned his attitude towards scripts, that basically the script was
he ditched it for Performance.
Yeah. Well, let's listen to him actually chatting with the screenwriter Alan Scott, who worked with Rogue, I think, on four different occasions. And this is Rogue explaining his attitude to what a screenplay is.
I really like working with a writer. I advance the script and we go away and then come back, and it's a marvellous thing. I enjoy working with the writer, but it is completely different from a playwright who arrives with a, for me, you know, I'm not saying this is the only way to go, but for film, I don't, I in fact, don't like a completed script in terms of, one has to for the finances and for the producers and things, but, you know, it isn't going to be like that. And so that change was happening. A lot of that was happening with, at that moment.
And that's Nicholas Rogue. And just as we finish up, Stephen Benedict, he mentions there this idea, I don't like the idea of a finished script. When it came to Walkabout, his 1971, which was the first film that he directed by himself, and I'm glad to see that we've gone out of chronological order to help our telling of Rogue, that he didn't even have the beginning of the screenplay when he started, did he?
No, he had about 14 pages, and he strung an absolutely magnificent film about cultural clashes and a rites of passage and being lost in a very, very hostile landscape. And then, brilliantly, in Rogue's unique way, he sexualized the landscape. That sounds absolutely absurd. How could he do that? But if I can just give you an idea what he does with his editing. There's a very, very famous scene in the movie Don't Look Now. There's a love scene in the film between Julie Christie and Donald Sutherland. And to give everyone an understanding of how cerebral and innovative his editing was, the scene begins with the two of the couple lying in a bed and they're reading a magazine, and the magazine is open at the centre page. So we see the spine of the magazine down the centre. And at that moment, Rogue cuts to Julie Christie running her hand down Donald Sutherland's spine. Now, what really is, what the idea there is, she's reading him as she's reading the magazine, because the couple have lost their child a couple of months previously. Their child drowned tragically in the back garden, and this is the first time they've been intimate with each other since. So she's actually reading his feelings, like it's Morse code on his spine, down the back of his spine. And that sort of idea that he can cross cut between one shot, he can juxtapose one shot and another shot in an unexpected way, really is innovative. And it's so innovative that Steven Soderbergh literally ripped off that entire sequence in Don't Look Now in his really, really slick thriller Out of Sight, starring Jennifer Lopez and George Clooney.
Well, listen, I tell you, Stephen, what you've done for me anyway is whetted my appetite to try to seek out some Nicholas Rogue films and go watch them, because there's clearly a lot to be seen within them. Stephen Benedict speaking to us about British film director Nicholas Rogue. An untimely death in the family inadvertently sent my next guest on the trail of an illicit affair, uncovering how its myriad complications impacted on her own family's history. Details of a love affair between Julia Parry's grandfather, Humphrey House, and the celebrated Irish writer, Elizabeth Bone, were revealed in detail when a dusty box of letters was bequeathed to Julia upon the sudden death of her uncle. The letters sent her on a journey of personal and indeed literary discovery, which she has recorded in her new book, The Shadowy Third, Love, Letters and Elizabeth Bone. And I'm delighted to have Julia Parry join me from her home in Madrid this evening. You know, it has the whiff of fiction about it, the box of dusty letters being handed over to the literary sleuth. What was your...
Yes, I know. And, I mean, it's very Bowen-esque in very many ways, because she has this whole idea that letters arrive in people's lives at the hour arranged. And I really felt that myself, that these letters arrived in my life at a time when I was ready and able to sort of take on a big project, never written a book before. And I just felt that I was required to do it, both by Bowen and by, of course, the fact that it was my family history. And if I didn't do it, someone else surely would.
And was that an immediate reaction, Julia, or did it take a little bit of time to persuade yourself that you should open up your family history like this?
No, I think I read the letters the year before that my uncle died. You mentioned the untimely death. I had read the letters and thought, gosh, aren't they amazing? I mean, Elizabeth in these letters is on one hand very vulnerable, on one hand, another hand, she's incredibly performative. And then there are lovely descriptive flourishes like the ones that you get in her fiction. And so I was really amazed by the sort of quality of the letters. But I did sort of put them to one side because I had a job and a life. But when my uncle died, that was the moment that I thought, OK, this is my project. And that was when I started.
Oh, so did you feel a generation, you kind of had to, certain people had to be out of the equation, as it were, before you could tell
no,
this story?
No, not at all. It wasn't that at all. In fact, my mother and my aunt, who are both in their 80s, have been massively supportive of this project and have read every draft and have, you know, obviously some of the subject matter is problematic because this is an extramarital affair and this is their parents I'm writing about. But they have been nothing but supportive of me bringing this, the whole story out, really.
Yeah, so well, let's get down to the I suppose that the nub of all of this is the relationship between Elizabeth Bone, who we all know as the writer, and your grandfather, Henry House. How did they meet? And the majority of the letters, not all of them, but the majority of the letters we get in the book are correspondence between the two of them, which tells us so much.
Yes, they are. They met in Oxford when Bowen was living in Oxford with her husband, Alan Cameron. She was in her early 30s. Humphrey House was a young fellow at Wadham College in his early 20s. So there's a 9-year age gap between them. And this was very much her first extramarital affair. He was sort of young and glamorous and intelligent. And I think that she possibly was wanting a little bit of adventure. She was in a very stable, companionate marriage, but without much passion in her life. And then he came along. When you read the letters, you do get the sense that they're wildly unsuitable for one another, but that makes for much better prose. Some of the letters are very engaging and they challenge one another and their ideas of gender and sexuality. So, and then the relationship built through the summer of 1933. In fact, Humphrey has spent a large part of that summer down at Bowen's Court at Elizabeth's home in County Cork. He completely fell in love with Ireland and fell in love with her home and her style of life. And so there are some lovely letters from him writing about her Irish life that are also included in the book.
Now, and that would all be so lovely and very interesting to read if it wasn't for the reality of the book's title here, which is The Shadowy Third. And The Shadowy Third here is your grandmother. So you're writing about, here are these great, wasn't my grandfather an awful rogue type of feeling you might get away with at one level. But then you have to think about The Shadowy Third, your grandmother. Where did she start to fit into your telling of the story?
Well, it's a very interesting question because initially, even though she's the only person in of the three of them who I met and knew and had a relationship with, I initially thought that the book was going to be about Humphrey and Elizabeth. And then really I realized that it was a much more interesting story to tell it as a love triangle. And also, if we actually look at what Elizabeth Bowen was writing at the time, she was writing a novel about a dysfunctional love triangle, which is The House in Paris, which was published in 1935. I know, we can sort of say we don't want fiction to be a reflection of her life, but I do think that some of that atmosphere of this awkward triangle did permeate into her fiction. As for my grandmother, she knew he was a rogue when she married him, and she went into her marriage with her eyes wide open. He, in fact, warned her of his possible infidelities. No marks for that from him. But I think the point, she decided that she was going to marry him and she stuck by him. The second thing that happened for me was I realized that there were letters between my grandparents that mentioned Elizabeth Bowen. And so when I found those going through other family papers, I knew that she had to have a place in the book. And then the final reason was that she wasn't some sort of mimsy little woman. She was actually quite an important literary figure in her own right. She was one of the first editors of Charles Dickens's letters. She worked on the project for 25 years. And the last thing I wanted was for her to be kind of the wronged wife. And so I really restructured the book quite profoundly to give her her place.
Yes, and she has a victory, it has to be said. You really do give her that victory as the story unfolds. But your grandmother also burned some letters, didn't she?
Yes, she did. And my aunt told me about the burning of the letters. And, I can only guess which letters those were. And I tried to sort of piece together the bits of the correspondence that did get burnt. And, one has to imagine what might have been in those letters. Mm. the good thing is that there are enough great letters left to be able to piece things together. And because Elizabeth Bowen was such a correspondent to so many other people, there was a massive amount of other information that I could get about the relationships, even with both Humphrey and with Elizabeth, from letters she wrote to other people. So I was able to fill in some of those gaps by looking at her other correspondence.
A vital part of the way you tell the story, Julia, is your own use of place and the different places that both your grandfather and grandmother lived in, the different places that Elizabeth Bowen lived in, and the different places where your grandfather and Elizabeth Bowen met. Reason enough, I suppose, to have place as very important. But what was your thinking in using place so much in the telling of the story?
Well, I think the great thing about Elizabeth Bowen for this project was she's obsessed with three things. She's obsessed with family ghosts, she's obsessed with letters, and she's obsessed with sense of place. To the point where she says, going to a place where something has happened, you get a vicarious thrill. You get some kind, she calls it place feeling. And I just really thought that I wanted to sort of honour her obsession with sense of place and the ghosts of place by going to all of these, by remapping it. And obviously, not, you know, strange happenings didn't occur in all of these places. I didn't meet physical ghosts, but it was a useful way of sort of charting the relationship, a new and a different way of being in correspondence, both with place and with people and with memory. And I wanted to have that idea of it being both a present story and a past story. It's something that Bowen plays around with a lot in her writing, is that the fluidity between the present and the past and the living and the dead.
How did your attitudes change to the three principles here, really, as the story went along? First of all, to Elizabeth Bowen?
Well, she's such a magnificent character. She really is. She is like a fictional character. She's a bit of a snob. She was quite unpleasant to my grandmother. My grandfather was a rogue, and he's always been a rogue. I think, however, what happened to me, and I think this is important, was that the central section of the book, when he leaves and goes to India after the end of the affair with Bowen, he comes into his own, and he is loved and respected enormously. And I felt that it was important for him not to be judged solely on, you know, being a bit of a ladies' man. He was a very complex character. And I think that my emotional development in terms of my relationship with him was the one that changed most during the course of the book.
And you know, as we've said, I think
21st century feminist, there were sort of eye roll moments when I was looking at my grandfather.
But your grandmother does become, I think, the hero of the book as it proceeds. Lovely to speak with you. Lovely to speak with you, Julia. Thanks so much for that.
Thank you
evening.
So much for having me on.
And that's Julia, okay. Julia Parry, and her book is called The Shadowy Third, Love Letters and Elizabeth Bowen, and it's published by Duckworth. That is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy researched, Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator, Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, once again here on RT Radio 1.